Welcome to the space show, Steve. Now, two Mars exploration rovers have a number of scientific instruments on board them. Could you introduce us to each one of them?
Sure. The payload really comes in two parts. One part is for remote sensing. It consists of two instruments. One is called PanCam. That's short for panoramic camera. It's a very high-resolution color stereo imager, 13 different colors, effectively 20/20 vision. The other instrument is called MINITEST. That stands for Miniature Thermal Emission Spectrometer. It's an infrared spectrometer, and we use it to look off in the distance and tell us what rocks are made of compositionally from a distance. Then when we drive up to a rock, we've got four more devices on the end of an arm. The arm's about the same dimensions as a human arm with a shoulder and an elbow and a wrist. And then on the hand, there are four devices. There's a microscope for close-up imaging. Two more spectrometers, one called an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer for telling us what elements are there, and one called a Mossbauer spectrometer for telling us which minerals are there. Then we have this device we call the RAT, R-A-T, the rock abrasion tool, which is a grinding wheel for grinding away the outer surface of a rock and exposing the interior to the instruments.
And which one's your favorite?
Oh, I love all my children equally.
No, that can't be right.
No, that is right. Actually, to be honest, each one at various times in the mission has played some just truly critical role for making some discovery. So without any one of them, the mission would not have worked the way it has.
So you're going to deny my next question, which is, which instruments made the greatest contribution to the mission?
You know, I really can't pick one. I mean, PanCam is a fundamental tool for helping us plan where we're going to drive, what we're going to do. MINITEST, we can identify different rock types from far away. And then you look at the discoveries that we've made. I mean, the blueberries, little round things in the rocks, the key there was the microscope. Some of the minerals, it's been the Mossbauer spectrometer, discovering the sulfates, that was the APXS. I mean, each one has been critical.
Now, in your book, you describe the incredible effort that you made to develop the instrumentation and the ongoing decisions to fly some and leave some behind. Now, what was the hardest instrument to remove from the spacecraft design?
Oh, the toughest one by far was the Raman spectrometer. We had a wonderful, wonderful instrument. Raman spectroscopy uses a laser to illuminate the surface, and you look at the radiation that's scattered back, and you can do pinpoint identification of individual mineral grains. It's a wonderful instrument, but it was just too big, too complex, wouldn't fit on the vehicle, and we weren't able to fly it. But that was a bitter disappointment not to be able to fly that one.
And what would have been its contribution? Identifying minerals, and would it have obviously much, much better than the trouble you've had, like rat grinding rocks, and then getting the existing spectrometer to see just the area of the rock and not the other dust.
Yeah, the key thing about the Raman was twofold. First of all, it really can isolate individual mineral grains, very, very small mineral targets, as opposed to sort of the large field of view that say, the Mossbauer spectrometer has. The other thing is that the Mossbauer spectrometer, which is our key mineral identification tool, only works on minerals that contain iron. If there's no iron in the mineral, it's invisible to the Mossbauer. That's not the case for the Raman. So it would have been a wonderful tool to have.
Now, if you had another chance to fly rovers of similar design, advanced design, similar, what changes would you make?
Boy, you know, that's a tough question. I think it would depend on whether we had more time or not. I mean, given the amount of time that we had, the amount of mass that we had, I don't think I'd do things very different. Now, if we could, if we had a little more time, if we had a little more mass to work with, I think the first thing that I'd go for would be a bit different power source. I mean, the solar arrays have worked, but having a nuclear power source would be great. But that just wasn't feasible for our mission.
That would be an RTG, wouldn't it?
That would be an RTG, yeah, and that would be a great thing to fly, but for our mission it wasn't feasible.
And that would have helped you during the winter as well, wouldn't it, just to keep things warm, let alone provide a power source?
It's just a steady, steady source of power. You don't have to rely on wind to clean off the solar arrays. You don't have to get lucky with the weather. You just got a steady power source.
Now, the mantra of the Mars Exploration Program for the first several years has been follow the water.
Right.
Now, why is that, and to what extent have Spirit and Opportunity been successful in that aim?
The reason that we follow the water is because water is an essential ingredient for life. There's no example anywhere on Earth of life that doesn't require liquid water, and everywhere on Earth you go where there's liquid water, you find life. Now, that doesn't mean that the same is true for Mars. It doesn't mean that if there was liquid water on Mars, there was life, but it is the scent that we follow, if you will. It's the tracer for environments that might have supported life. I would say that both Opportunity and Spirit have been successful in finding evidence of water, though particularly Opportunity. Spirit has found evidence that in the Columbia Hills, where we've spent most of the mission, water has flowed through the rocks, has changed their chemistry. But at the Opportunity site, there was water on the surface. There was water flowing across the surface. It was drenched in liquid water at the Opportunity site. So Opportunity in particular has been very successful in that regard.
Now, you landed at Gusev Crater and Mirodani on the Mirodani Plain. Do you wish you'd landed elsewhere? Have you been happy, in other words, where you landed? Because I know it was a difficult choice, wasn't it?
It was a very difficult choice. I've been thrilled with the Mirodani site. I mean, that's where Opportunity landed, and you couldn't have asked for more there. The Gusev site did not turn out the way we had planned. At the Gusev Crater site where Spirit landed, we landed on what we hoped might be ancient lake beds. And while I'm sure the sediments are still there somewhere, they have been buried under lava. And all we saw for the first 156 days of the mission was that lava. Now, since then, we have been fortunate. We've been able to drive a very long distance and climb up into the Columbia Hills, where we have found good evidence for water. It wasn't the evidence that we went looking for. It wasn't what we expected. But it's been a good mission anyway. It's worked out well for us just because of the longevity that we've had. You know, it's hard to say whether you'd pick something different or not because the factors that control your site selection are not just science. In fact, they're not even primarily science. It's safety first. If you don't have a safe landing, you get no science at all. We had a site in the Valles Marineris and the big canyon system on the equatorial region of Mars that would have been really nice if we'd been able to pull it off. Beautiful site, layered rocks, probably sediments, spectacular scenery. I mean, a huge mountain ranges off to the sides, but it's probably a very windy place. And we rejected that site for safety reasons. We think that if we tried to land there, the winds might have been too much and would have killed the vehicle on touchdown. So given what we had to work with, I'm happy with where we ended up, especially because we were able to get to the Columbia Hills.
If you did land in the Valles Marineris,
yeah,
the Mariner Valley, and you're in the middle of it, would you actually see the cliffs on the other side, or is the valley so big that would not?
You'd see it. I mean, they're 8 kilometers tall. It'd be hard to miss.
just thinking they might be over the horizon, you know,
no,
the curvature of Mars.
No, you'd see them.
Okay. Now, if you had a third rover, where would you land it?
Well, you know, if you had a third one, I got to say that Valles Marineris site would be tempting. You know, the more rovers you got, the more willing you might be to take a little risk with one. And given how well the landing system has performed, especially, if I had a third one, man, the Valles Marineris would be very, very tempting.
Now, you're obviously surprised and delighted that the two rovers have lasted well past their baseline 90-day mission.
I'm astonished. I am absolutely astonished.
Okay. Now, is there more to do at Gusev Crater and Mirodani?
Yeah.
Or can we expect more of the same sort of stuff until the rovers do finally die?
There's much more to do at both places, especially at the Gusev site. We keep finding completely new rock types. I mean, it seems like every few weeks we'll find something that is just completely different from anything we've seen before. It's bewildering at times. There are so many different kinds of rocks in this place. Gusev in particular just seems to keep throwing new stuff at us. Mirodani, for the last several months, quite a few months, 5 or 6 months, we've been driving across these sort of flat, sandy plains, and we haven't seen a whole lot of bedrock, but we are just now on the verge of just getting into a vast area of bedrock, and we've just taken our first taste of it just in the past couple of weeks, and it's different. It's different from what we saw before, 3 kilometers to the north. How different it will be as we work our way south, I do not know, but I will tell you that if we can get through this area of bedrock, beyond that is a massive impact crater, which is a kilometer in diameter, and it's got these 40-meter cliffs of layered rock, which is like nothing we've seen before. So there's great stuff out there for both vehicles still.
And do you have realistic hopes of reaching that crater?
I don't know. It's awfully far away. You know, it probably depends in part on how much good science there is between here and there. If there's a lot of good science, we'll stop some to look at it. That's always a tough call to make because, you know, when you got pretty good stuff in front of you and wonderful stuff out ahead of you, but it's a long ways off, which do you focus on? It sort of depends on how long you think the vehicle's going to last, and we don't know. You know, if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said there's no chance we're going to get to Victoria Crater. You ask me now, you know, maybe we got a shot. We'll see. I don't know.
It always surprised me that you landed at Miradani, except for the hematite.
Yeah.
Because you look around and there's just a few craters and it's just flat, sandy terrain for long distance in every direction, and you landed there.
Well, my biggest fear at the Miradani site was that we were going to touch down and not be able to find bedrock anywhere, that it was so smooth and so flat that we simply wouldn't find any rock. And if we only drove 600 meters, which was the design goal for the vehicle, it wasn't clear that we would find bedrock at all. And then landing night, we rolled to a stop right in this 20-meter crater. It was a 300 million mile hole in one. And man, that was one of the luckiest nights of my life.
I'll say. Now, in your book, you say that you expected the rovers to eventually be rendered immobile because of the winter sun, and it wouldn't be able to provide enough power to the motors.
Yep.
But you survived the winter. How did you do that?
Topography. You know, we planned to land these things where it was flat, but we drove so far, we covered so much ground, that we were able to find places where the land was just plain steep. For example, at Miradani, by the time winter got there, we had driven into this big bowl-shaped crater. And the thing about a crater like that, you know, it's got these 20, 25, 30-degree slopes all the way around, and you can just pick your slope. So we picked the one that was facing north, which is where the sun is in the sky in the wintertime, and we were able to tilt the solar arrays towards the sun and survive the winter there. At Gusev, we did the same thing in the Columbia Hills. We climbed onto the north-facing slope, tilted the solar arrays, and I'll tell you, Spirit would not have made it through the winter. There's no way that Spirit would have survived that winter if it had been out on flat ground. But on that north-facing slope, we made it.
Now, what do you think will be the likely things that kill the rovers in the end? Including money, perhaps?
Yeah, what's likely to kill the rovers? It's not going to be money. NASA has made it very clear that as long as the rovers are alive and moving and doing good science, they're going to keep funding the mission. You know, we thought it was going to be dust. We thought it was going to be dust on the solar arrays, but I'm starting to believe that may not be it. We keep having these wonderful gusts of wind that have cleaned them off. Could be mechanical wear. You know, there are a lot of moving parts on these things. The one that worries me the most is electronic parts. One of the things that's very tough for electronics is temperature changes, and you know, temperature difference between daytime and nighttime on Mars is like 100 degrees centigrade. And so we're seeing these enormous temperature swings, and we've been through 584 of them now. And, you know, that's real tough on electronics. So we could have an electronic parts failure, and the things could die tomorrow. So I don't know. I mean, they could last for another year, another 2 years, or they could be dead in a week. And I just don't know what it's going to be.
Thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Steve.
Glad to be here.